Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kara Warren. And today on the show, we have Lou Bank, the executive director and founder of Sacred Agave, a non-for-profit group working to improve lives in the rural Mexico communities where heirloom agave spirits are made. And we have Chava Parabon, who manages projects for Sacred on the ground in Mexico. And Chava and Lou are also hosts of a podcast called Agave Road Trip that helps bartenders understand agave spirits like mezcal and tequila. Lou and Chava, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thank you very much, Kara.
Yeah.
But I think there was something fundamental that you didn't mention in the mission of our podcast. It's specifically gringo bartenders, the kids that were interested.
Hey, not gringo, it's gringex.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Just the people that are from somewhere else, just someone that is not from where those spirits are being made. Because those guys already know that, right?
Exactly.
So they don't need our help.
I love that you guys already have the enthusiasm and the spirit that it takes to teach people about agave spirits and about all things foodie wise, because it is hard to break the ice. I feel like, you know, and you guys are dealing with like some serious stuff in Mexico. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. You'll tell me in a moment. Actually, I'm going to pitch it to, you know, hey, I don't, you know, because it's in the news, right? I only see one. I'm seeing one perspective of this. You guys might know better. I actually am going to throw it to Lou because I'd like for him to kind of break down what Sacred Agave is and how it's helping people in these specific communities in Mexico. Lou, what is it? What is it that you guys are doing down there?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the kind of thing where I could literally talk for 2 hours just about.
And you don't want that. Like nobody wants Lou talking for 2 hours. I can guarantee that. So
spoken as a guy who was stuck in a car with me for 5 hours over the last few days, I think you're the right person to say that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what we're trying to do at Sacred is to help improve quality of life in the rural Mexican communities where these spirits are made. And the truth is really, that's sort of a strategy, not a goal. And what I mean by that is, you know, what I keep coming back around to is this notion that in some of these rural communities, not all of them, but in some of them, the ones that I really find myself drawn to, they don't really seem to have much consideration for the concept of efficiency. And while that sounds like a joke and sounds like I'm sort of making fun of them, it's, you know, my whole life, my world is about how to do things in a more efficient way. And then I see these rural communities where instead they're focused on best results. And it's a very different worldview, a different approach to solving problems. And I think that there is some real genius in that approach. It's not to say that, you know, this world that just gave us the vaccine to this this virus that has been locking us down. Like, I'm really grateful for the efficient world that I live in. But I think that we can find better and more sustainable answers to problems like water insecurity and food insecurity and climate change by having more conversations with people who live with this different worldview. The problem is that this different worldview is sort of at risk of disappearing because we keep doing things like drinking more mezcal. And the result of drinking more mezcal is that the efficient world is starting to encroach on these communities. And, you know, one of the biggest problems is the farms where these families who have been making mezcal for multiple generations, these families where they've been purchasing their agaves, those farms are being bought up by the multinational liquor companies in order to support the production of more and more and more mezcal. And, you know, I don't want you to hear that as some kind of indictment on these multinational liquor companies. They're just giving what we ask them for. But I want to ensure the sustainability. And it's kind of arrogant of me to state it this way, but I want to help sustain these families with this multi-generational wisdom, because I don't think we can afford to lose that wisdom. So, you know, one of the biggest programs that we have at Sacred, see, I eventually got back around to it. One of the biggest programs we have at Sacred is replanting agave. We provide agave seedlings to these families. So that, you know, in lots of 500 to 750 plants, so that when those agave reach maturity, they have the solution. They own the solution. It doesn't belong to some farm that could sell it out from under them.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and I think that something that Lou is saying, and I just had this conversation with the taxi driver that picked me up at 5 a.m. today. He told me how he grew up in rural Mexico when he was a child in a very similar fashion that my father did. And we were discussing insecurity in Mexico City. And he, as my father will tell you, they didn't know what a thief was. They wouldn't even steal like milk or a cow from each other, right?
In Mexico City?
No. Well, even in Mexico, my mother, who grew up in Mexico City, I mean, she's also from Michoacan, but she grew up in Mexico City. And she used to tell a story about being 14 and driving her bicycle by himself from like Tacubaya to UNAM, which is some good like 14 kilometers, and everybody thinking that was absolutely fine having a 14-year-old driving her bicycle that distance. So it's rural Mexico doesn't only inform what we understand today as rural Mexico, but it also used to, and still informs in many ways, a city that a lot of people will think is one of the most gargantuan, industrially constructed cities, right?
Right, right. I'm trying to figure out. See how you're saying like the culture of Mexico is changing, and we're trying to get away from these bigger spirit groups. So I want to get back to Sacred and also mention, like, what does that even stand for? Like, I realized as I was looking at your website, who came up with the acronym, and can you tell the listeners what it is?
Yeah, sure. So the acronym stands for Saving Agave for Culture, Recreation, Education, and Development. And I just came up with it one night while I was drinking. And I was thinking I wanted to have some kind of event that was a fundraising event. And, I wanted to have a fun name for it, and then the name struck me. But the truth is, like, since I came up with it, I feel a little hamstrung by it, because everyone refers to the organization as Sacred Agave. To me, the thing that's sacred isn't the agave. It's the people who work with it, right? It's that multi-generational wisdom that they're shepherding from their forebearers. And really, am I saving agave, or trying to help save agave, I should say? And even that, I don't think so. It's more like I'm sharing agave for culture, recreation, education, and development.
And I think that something that we're talking about with Steven Alvarez, we're a good friend that has a program called Tackle Literacy. He has one phrase that really struck me, and I had never actually thought about it that way. But he, in a way, said, you know, you cannot love a culture's food and not love that culture's people. And it seems like in today's world, sometimes there happens to be sometimes a disconnect, right? Where I love mezcal, but oh, you know, the people that are making the mezcal, not that much. I think that's why it's so important making this distinction, where it's not so much the agricultural product or the final product, but it's everything that it's around that supports this, what is really worth taking a moment to preserve and restore in so many ways.
And you know, that's the point. That's actually why I have you guys on, because it's like cheese has that very similar ideology. Like, we're always trying to relate it back to like the farmers and sustainability, and how can we help these people who have been like keeping this tradition alive? So it's funny how this is all connected. I love that. Chava, I'm going to give you another fun question. How do you define heirloom agave spirits? And I know you talk about this all the time, but if for the listeners, the new cheese listeners who are trying to learn one-on-one here, help us out.
Well, actually, it's funny because I rarely use the word heirloom too. Actually, I love that Heritage Radio is called Heritage, because I usually I refer more to heritage agave spirits. And it's actually something that I use not only to call agave spirits, I love to talk about heritage material culture. And the way that I like to define it, it's a tradition and, yeah, a set of practices that are informed by the richness and diversity that a group of people and a specific ecosystem has to offer. So it's kind of that clash between rather sophisticated cultures and rather diverse ecosystems, what I think are the two magic elements that create heritage agave spirits of heritage agave, heritage material culture.
Okay, so basically, we're going to keep learning more about this, because there's so much I don't understand still, but I'm going to learn now. I wanted to...
You know, in a nutshell, like if we're talking soccer, it'll mm-hmm. be a really good soccer player in a beautiful field. That's what creates heritage. That's what gives Pele.
Excellent.
You know, boy, that seems so abstract to me, Chava. You know, to me, it's very simply like when I use the phrase heritage agave spirits, I'm talking about spirits that are made primarily through pre-industrial processes, right? Using tools that are generally made by hand or primarily made by hand, and doing things that you're just not finding feasible at a mass level.
Yeah, but you know, the complicated part there, and I'm sorry if I'm getting too into the weeds, and I know Lou is going to give me a little bit of trouble for this, but it's when
this isn't our show.
Well,
that's
right?
True. This is a cheese show. God, this is going to
give me a little bit of.
No. I'm trying to learn about this because I mean, the whole crux of this is also at some point in the episode we're going to talk about cheese pairings with mezcal. Because I thought it would be cool to try that out, because I've never done that before. So, I mean, like, this is all like getting the background and what is mezcal. And then also, it was your website that said heirloom agave spirits on it. So I'm going with the jargon that you guys put out there. But I understand now it's heritage agave spirits, you know?
Yeah, that's funny. Initially, I was using heirloom, and then Chava came along and he started using the word heritage. I thought, oh yeah, no, that speaks better to what we're doing. And I thought I had changed it on the website, which, well, I'll find. We'll talk about that afterwards. You can point me to the page.
That's a side conversation.
Well, no, like just heritage for me has to do more. Like the biggest marker for heritage product, I don't believe that it's scale. I believe that it's one of the markers that allows you to see something that most likely is heritage versus something that it's more of an industrial product. But when does too big is too big, right? As we say in Spanish, que tanto es tantito, how little is too little. It's really hard to define it from that perspective. So that's a discussion that we'll have to have with Lou in a more aggressive fashion later on.
Yeah, that's a whole episode, actually. I never realized that you viewed it differently.
No, but I would like to put out to the listeners that you guys, again, you do Agave Road Trip on Heritage Radio Network. You're a sister show, so I want to make that point out there. So my follow-up question to actually Chava's point, amen, a second ago, yeah, exactly, is how have you guys seen the mezcal market change in the last 5 years, or has it not changed? I mean, you tell me.
Yeah, oh,
well,
no, it's...
Can I tell a story about that? Lou, just happened today. I talked with a 16-year-old, and
1-6 or 6-0.
One six. Yeah, I usually talk with 6-0, but today I had the invaluable chance to talk to a teenager, which hadn't happened in my life in a long time. And the guy was very curious about, he's the son of somebody I work for, and he was telling me like, oh, because Mezcal is massive, right? Mezcal has always been popular. It's always been the coolest thing out there. I was like, well, yeah, since you can remember. So it depends who you ask, Kara. If you ask a teenager, they think it's been the coolest thing forever. If you ask us, I honestly don't think it has changed that much. I think...
Maybe if she asks you, oh, I have a completely different view.
Really? Well, I just think it hasn't changed that much because the same things that I think we were trying to showcase as valuable and fortunate stuff, we are still trying to showcase as valuable and fortunate. So for me, the values that started this are still there. That's how I see that.
Oh, I would agree that you can still find the values, but the values of, again, that of that multi-generational wisdom are, while they are the same size they had been and maybe growing a little bit, like we can see, well, I think the value of the industrial side of Mezcal is growing significantly. Like the market is growing at a rate that's just unheard of, right? And that growth is being fueled not by this beautiful small stuff that we love so much, but rather by the industrial, I shouldn't say industrially made, because there's very little mezcal that is made in an industrial manner, but in stuff that leans closer to industrial, right? So that's where the growth is. But because you're seeing all that growth and all that money coming into the market, you're also seeing some of these families who were at risk of losing their children to the tradition, where the children were saying, well, I don't really see this as a future for me. Suddenly some of those children are coming back to it. So it's sort of this two-prong change where the market continues to grow. It's now 1.9% of the, by volume, of the tequila market. Whereas if we looked at it 5 years ago, it was half that. And that growth is fueled by stuff that's aimed at the broader, more industrialized marketplace, but that's also bringing some of these families back into the traditions. So it's sort of two directions.
Yeah, and it's also fascinating. Every time we talk to these guys, one very consistent comment they'll say is, we never thought Mezcal was going to be this valuable money-wise. We never thought people were willing to pay these prices for this thing. And a lot of them are actually, I think, very nervous that this is going to somehow go back to where it was before. Because I don't know if this is familiar for you, Kara, but Mezcal used to be very badly seen as a liquor. It used to, or a spirit. Usually the joke was that if you were drinking mezcal, you were also using crystal meth. So it was
In Mexico, that was the joke.
Well, in the kids that I knew at the time, which probably is going to tell a lot about myself. But it was not seen as a prestigious thing. And the fact that today it is sometimes even more expensive than whiskey has a lot of the producers extremely confused.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it at a lot of different restaurants and wine bars and different spirit bars now, and it's really interesting to see how it's changed. So what I would like to do real quick, because you guys are just awesome, I want to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll discuss the different mezcal styles. So hey, everyone, you're listening to Cutting Curd, and we will be right back.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin, in the USA. Conte is a raw milk cooked pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Conte within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Comté. Comté takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineurs on average, each wheel of Comté is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Comté is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Comté is unique. Learn more about Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to Cutting the Curd. I'm your host, Kara Warren, and today on the show, I have Lou and Chava of Agave Road Trip / Sacred Agave. They keep communities in Mexico alive with their mezcal skills, and right now, we're actually going to break down the different styles of mezcal, because I know so little, I didn't even realize there were this many styles of mezcal, and we will try to just do the general versions, but Lou or Chava, who would like to take this?
Well, are you talking about the mezcal that you shoot and the mezcal you sip, or how we divide into the
Chava,
different categories?
You've got to look at the notes, brother. There's notes here.
I'm all excited about answering this.
Let me take this one, and Chava, you take the next one.
There we go. We'll do that.
Yes. Okay. So, right. So when you're talking about styles, I guess because you didn't finish the question the way it's written. But when you're talking about styles,
I didn't want to say all the names.
I get that. That can be intimidating. Like what you sent us was a list of different agaves, and you know if you think about the different agaves as being styles, that's sort of like saying that the different kinds of grapes that make wine are different styles. And, you know, to me, the more interesting way to look at styles is the style of production, right? So you've got all these different ways that you're cooking the agave. You know, you can cook it underground in order to, what you have to do is get the sugars to become fermentable sugar. So you're cooking the agave underground, or you're steaming it, or maybe you're even blasting it with chemicals. Like there's all these different ways you can do that. You can mill it by hand. You can mill it by using a wood chipper. You can mill it by using a stone wheel called a tahona that's pulled by a horse, or sometimes it's pulled by a bull, or sometimes it's pulled by an electric cart. You can ferment it open air in wooden barrels, or you can ferment it in the skin of a bull, like a sack made from bull skin, or you can ferment it in closed steel tanks like almost everything else we drink is fermented. And then you can distill in wood-fired copper pot stills, or you can distill in wood-fired clay pot stills. There are some stills that have wooden components to them. Like there's all these different methods. And to me, like that's where, if you're looking at styles, it gets most interesting. But also then that tends to speak to the hand of the maker. It took me years to come around to this idea where I thought I was trying to find the agave. There's like two to 300 different kinds of agave. I thought I was trying to find the agave that spoke to my palate, but really in the end, turns out I was trying to find the maestro mezcalero, the maker who spoke to my palate. Because it's just like a chef, when they make something that they think tastes great, and to you it tastes great, try everything they make and go deep, and you won't be disappointed.
Yeah, and just a fine note on that too. It's I think something that it's marvelous about the agave spirits context is that you get to taste communities. You get to taste what a whole community understands as being delicious. So I think right now, usually with, you know, like the way we consume food, sometimes we think that it's the genius of one person, which is very valuable. And in this case, you're tasting the genius, the collective genius of hundreds of years and thousands of people synthesizing a spirit. And that it's a consequence of the technologies, the terroir, all those things are synthesizing a spirit.
And Chava, you just mentioned terroir, because that was my follow-up question, was going to be, What is it like in Mexico? What is that like? Terroir? I've never thought about terroir in terms of Mexico, which sounds ridiculous. I should have associated it. But like, could you give us some background on that? Because I know it's a French, more of a French term and more of a European way to look at things. But how does that work in terms of Mexico?
But the French spent some time in Mexico. So,
well, for me, it's okay. Really funny because, you know, I happened to live in the south of France when I was 17. And I got to travel, I'll say, most of Western Europe, a good chunk of Eastern Europe. I'll say like the only place where I haven't been in Western Europe, it's Ireland and Portugal. And of course, there's a lot of differences in the type of weathers and the type of vegetation and the hills and the valleys that you see. But when you are in Mexico, when you drive for 6 hours from the mountains of Michoacán to the coast, it's so drastically, overwhelmingly different. And just, you know, you can be 30 minutes away from a place and that's avocado capital of the world. And then 30 minutes away from that, you cannot grow one avocado to save your life. So I just think it's probably the only other place that I've seen that has such aggressive, crazy transitions of terroir is Taiwan. But there's a reason why the Portuguese used to call it Formosa, right? So for me, it's just... it's probably one of the most complicated puzzles when it comes down to terroir, what we have in Mexico right now.
But is that helpful for mezcal then?
Oh, yes, absolutely. For so many reasons. It's not only that agave gets different spaces or ecosystems in which it has to grow, but it's also a lot of it is wild fermentation. So you have different places where same agave, same technology to produce it, but if you are a little bit higher, a little bit under, just the cultivars of yeast are going to be so drastically different, and the spirit is going to taste like something that you've never think that came from the same area.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I'd also say that when you're talking about terroir, to me, particularly when you're talking about terroir in mezcal, that you have to talk about the water.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, the water, at the end of the day, the water is going to be right around half, generally, around half of what's in that bottle. And the flavors of the water that so often will come from springs or wells will be informed, as Chava says, by the land itself. And you get all these different mineralities to it that I think are so distinct in that end product.
Yeah, we even had the opportunity to go to a salt mine that, according to them, I mean, I don't know how they counted this, but is millions of years old. I mean, not the people working it, but the geological formation. And they had dozens of different salts that they could give to you there with different tests of salinities. And a few kilometers away from there, they were making some of the most beautiful mezcalas we've ever tried. So, I mean, that's just like all these different variables that get to inform this drink.
Right. And then, like, I also want to bring up the point about aging because cheese gets aged. Mezcal seems to go through some aging as well. Or does it not matter? You can tell me. But when I was reading the different labels, it's Oven, Reposado, Año. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, those were the three I noticed. But does it matter? What do you think?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely it matters. So the third one you were looking for was Añejo.
I knew I'd be the Gringex there.
It's okay. Normally I'm the Gringex, so it's nice to have somebody else fill that role. So yeah, it's absolutely going to matter. You'll have some people tell you, the agave geeks, that aging mezcal and wood is not traditional, but Chava and I have seen on our trip so many pictures that provide all the evidence we need that, in fact, it is historical. And of course it's historic because you had to store your mezcal somewhere. And storing it in wood is going to be one of the more traditional ways. Storing it in clay is also a traditional way. Storing in glass, storing in plastic is, you know, it's traditional if you count tradition as 50 years, right?
Yeah.
So generally the plastic, you know, is not going to give an off taste to it if it's been used long enough and it's food grade. The glass aging to me is the most interesting.
Yeah, that's when it gets cool. Yeah, that's go Lou.
Yeah, because you're like just sitting in the glass, you think that, well, the glass can't possibly change anything. But people forget that glass is not a completely solid object. Things come in and go out.
No. That's, if you're going to talk about micro-oxygenation, it doesn't have to do with the oxygen traveling through the glass. Yeah, like glass is absolutely not porous in any capacity.
Well, sure it is. Otherwise, you wouldn't have flow glass.
No. but that's a whole different thing. The aging in glass, there's two variables that can actually affect the spirit. One will be that if you have a cork that in some capacity is allowing an exchange with air, there's been almost no studies about this, but there might be that some possible micro-oxygenation is possibly altering the spirit in some way.
Oh, it would have to get in at least that way. If you think about the corks they use, what are they, Java?
Well, they're usually corn husks.
Exactly. So it's an imperfect seal. So you gotta have that going in.
Yeah, through the seal. Okay.
Well, but I'd still, well, that's an argument for yet another podcast.
That's another episode.
Anyway,
that's another
and
episode.
Then, and then, yeah, yeah. But then there's also, are you aging it in glass above ground or underground? Because you'll find people who just bury these 20-liter glass jugs, garrafones. And so that in itself, and then you've got like absolutely no light hitting it, and you've got very constant temperature. But then you'll also hear from some of the people who do that, that really the effect is that you've got the earth coming in and out of the glass. So, you know, are you saying no, that they don't say that, Chava?
I've never heard that, and I hope they don't
seriously
say that.
Oh, I've absolutely heard that. In fact, that's why one of the families was burying it in goat dung specifically.
Yeah, well, I think the answer that I...
right.
The answer that I think it's more feasible is that because of the technologies used for distilling mezcal, you have a lot of lipids traveling to the other side that they don't get to dissolve immediately when the spirit is young. So if you leave it, if you leave an alcohol and water solution with some lipids in there and other stuff that we don't really know what they are, they get to dissolve better into the spirit, and therefore it changes through time. That for me is the most, reasonable explanation that I've heard about this. But I mean, honestly, too, is that we're very, very jealous of the cheese context because you guys have so many academics, like such a great, wonderful medium of information, whereas mezcal has a lot more humble, bibliography available these days.
And then you don't even believe them when they say that there's something different about earth and goats.
Well, I wouldn't call those kids the academics, but whatever. The fact that Lou and I are fighting over this is perfect because most of the things that we know about agave spirits might change. It's almost like researching about Egypt, right? Today you think this was the ultimate thing they said, and tomorrow, they found something else.
Yeah.
So that's a very common situation with this thing.
Yeah, I feel mycology is like that too.
Yeah. So just to put a cap on the aging thing, so because we haven't even talked about aging wood, right? So with reposado, in order to qualify as a reposado mezcal, it has to be aged between 6 months and 12 months in wood. And then for añejo, it has to be a year or more in wood.
Okay.
And of course, you know, you put any kind of alcohol solution in wood and it's going to start pulling things out of the wood.
Okay.
Yep. But I think it works very, very different than cheese. So usually you're just wanting to extract wood with alcohol and dilute it into the spirit, which also Lou and I, unfortunately, we don't have our cheese game very high up. So I wouldn't be able to explain what the maturing process does in the case of cheese.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we have affineurs for. That's what we have the academics for, that on this program, because they can talk about it at length and break things down for sure. But a lot of it is about protein breakdown. But that's a whole other story as well. I wanted to ask you one more one-on-one question for the new listeners out there. I know Chava breathes with me on this one. But how do you distinguish tequila and mezcal? And then we're going to get into the cheese stuff.
Like, I mean, how I personally distinguish it, one makes me remember the worst decisions of my life, and the other one makes me remember the best decisions of my life. But I'm not going to say which one is which, but I think Lou has a better, clear-cut, good answer for that one.
So what I like to say is there's really, so it's basically tequila, they're both denominations of origin. And so there are rules about how you can make them and where you can make them. But the truth is, for the most part, it's about where you make it. Tequila can only be made in 5 states, primarily Jalisco, but there are 4 other states you can make it. And then mezcal can be made now in 10 states, though most of it is made in Oaxaca. There's some crossover in those states, like Michoacan, you can make both of them. So it's where you make it. And then tequila can only be made using one agave, Blue Weber agave. And then mezcal can be made with any agave. Now with tequila, you don't have to use 100% agave unless you call it 100% agave tequila. You can use up to 49% sugars from some other source except another agave. With mezcal, it has to be 100% agave, that the sugars that were used to ferment.
Yeah, but so it's rather technical. It's I think Lou just made an excellent job in pointing out some of the most relevant difference between one and the other. But in a nutshell, there's just different rule books. They're just different denominations of origins.
Yeah, but having said that, I think the significant difference is if I've got a wall with 100 bottles of tequila on it and I randomly place my hand on one of those bottles, I've got about a 1 in 50 chance of putting my hand on something that has been made using some level of pre-industrial methods. Whereas if that same wall had 100 bottles of mezcal on it, and I randomly put my hand on one of those bottles, I've got about a 1 in 50 chance of putting my hand on something that was made entirely industrially. So it's almost like it's almost the exact opposite situation. And as a result, I think that when you just randomly drink a mezcal, you've got a greater chance of being able to taste some of these heritage processes that have disappeared as a result of industrialization.
Yeah, but also I think that something that I find fascinating about tequila is that you get to, like, from almost a more academic perspective, you get to try the same agave transformed with just different tiny tweaks in process. And I find that absolutely fascinating, because in mezcal, like, the thing is so diverse that it's really hard to understand a lot of how this decision affected this flavor. Whereas in tequila, I think it's a little bit more approachable if you want to understand a little bit more about that. So that's a reason why I really love exploring or experimenting with tequila on my palate.
Chava, I wanted to ask you, how do you choose a mezcal? Because there is all these, like, you look at the label, and then how do you begin to process mezcal at this point?
He'll just drink whatever you give him.
Whatever's closest? Okay, good to know.
No. I mean, Lou is actually right. But honestly, if I can give the more sophisticated answer, it's usually something that I am not familiar with. I think I choose mezcal the same way that I choose my books, right? If I have enough peripheral information about it, in the sense that I can understand that there's certain complexity to it, and it's a region that I've never heard about, and it's a name or a process that I've never heard about, I am just going to jump on top of that. Usually, I wouldn't choose or drink something that I've already liked or that I've already explored, just because I don't want to get bored. I want to get excited. I want to keep on being excited about this category.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we're all foodies and drinkers. I'm curious, then, have you guys ever done cheese pairings with mezcal?
We just did one. We just did one.
You did one. I didn't. I just watched. I'm a vegan now. I can't do cheese pairings.
Poor Lou, it's a disabled
entity these days.
You know, I will say the one pairing I did before my world became vegan, it's fairly recent, was the first pairing that you're doing, the La Luna Cupriata, right? So in Michoacán, where La Luna Cupriata is made, the family that makes it also has been making cotija cheese for so long, and their cotija cheese is so freaking delicious. And so I was for about a month before my cardiologist shut it down, I was eating the cotija cheese and drinking their Cupriata from the same place, and it was absolutely delicious.
Yeah, I think your question was directed towards how will we approach it, no?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Like, and then I was going to ask you about cotija cheese and like how it pairs. Like, do you do more aged cotija cheese when you do a mezcal pairing? What do you prefer?
Ooh, I mean, this last one we did was in the, we were super lucky because it was in the French Board. Mm-hmm. Is it in the Soho, Lou? Like,
yeah, I'm French sure you guys, cheese board. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The French yeah. cheese board. And we had the privilege of the guy working there, which had absolute experience with this, choosing all the cheeses. I think if you had asked us to do that, we would have just been terrified to the bone and wouldn't have known how to start. And honest to God, I wouldn't be able to tell a formula or a way to do it, but I just know that what happened to my body that day was religious. And so I don't have an answer, but I know that trying to find an answer will be an extremely useful endeavor.
Oh my goodness.
Well, you know, I think it's sort of, I mean, you know, when we've approached tastings before, I think it's like anything else. It's just, I had this really beautiful experience once when I was working for a brewery where I reached out. It was a microbrewery in Portland, Oregon called Rogue Ales. And I had reached out randomly, this was in 2002, to Snake River Farms, which makes or raises cattle that qualify as American style Kobe beef. And I'd reached out to them because my boss had said, hey, we want to have the perfect beer burger combo in our pubs. Go talk to these guys. And so I said to them, hey, I want to do this. We want to pair up your burger, this Kobe American style Kobe beef burger, with the perfect beer. And they said, well, okay, great. What is the perfect combination? And I said, I don't know. So they sent me 40 pounds of steak. Like, I think it's, you know, I think that's as academic as I get, is just put it all in front of me and let me just go into it and figure out what tastes good together. And sometimes, right, you're trying to get flavors that that are similar, and then you're sometimes looking for flavors that are completely opposite of each other. And then you've also got, you know, textures that you're trying to match up or that you're trying to find departure points from. You've got acids and fats. So there's all this stuff you can play with whenever you're pairing anything.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, I realized when I was working on the pairings for these things, like, so with the Joven mezcal, it was like super hot. Like, it, you know, it's very high alcohol. So to weigh the play that, I definitely felt it needed a sharper cheese. And then I realized, of course, cotija would be the way to go. But then I also had like the Esfuerzo Tepezate. I don't know if I'm saying that perfectly, but that was like very leathery, earthy. So I was like blue cheese all the way on that, or an extra aged Gouda. I mean, it was very interesting to play around with this and see the different levels, because it does go from even some smoother ones versus like the sort of citrusy ones that could go with a goat cheese or a brie. I did have a lot of fun with this. I'll probably post this in the notes on the show. This way people can read the names. It might be a little more clear. It was a lot of fun. What were you going to say, Chava? I'm sorry. I interrupted you a moment ago.
Oh, no. Whatever I was going to say, definitely you made a better version of that. that sounds fascinating. I really want to just look at the, like, all of your notes and try to find cheeses in Mexico that will have that, because again, like as Lou is saying, it's just, I don't know, it's almost like listening to your favorite music being remixed in a way that you never thought was possible, and then for it to make absolute sense. So yeah, I mean, I just think it's really exciting.
Yeah, you guys are going to learn more about cheese through me. I'll probably go on your show at some point. I hope. I'm inviting myself so that we can like cover the cheese zone to the Mezcal group. Because, you know, it's fun to share the listeners.
Yeah, honestly, what I'm thinking, Kara, is that what we'll do is we'll grab a bunch of cheeses from Mexico and just I'll smuggle them back with me. And then like we'll have you talk to us about those cheeses and what they tell you about the places awesome. They were made. And how they might pair with things you would normally taste with cheese or drink with cheeses up here.
Oh, that would be absolutely the greatest thing. I would love to do that. That would be dope. And if you're the smuggler, I'm all in. That's it.
Well, Lou has not a lot of talents, but if he has one, it's that one.
Oh, my goodness.
That just put me on the radar of all of Homeland Security. Thanks for that, Chava.
Always trying to serve you, Lou. Always trying to make your life fun.
So I just wanted to say a big thank you to having you guys on the show today, by the way. This was awesome. I had a lot of fun. And I wanted to know, what can we look forward to on – do you have any upcoming content that we should look forward to on your show?
God, probably not. What do you think, Chava?
Oh, we have so much stuff. Oh, are you kidding me, Lou? We just spent a whole week talking to people about crazy stuff we're going to make. I mean, I'm trying to get agave. We're going to make an agave wine. That's on the works. There's coffee. There's beer with agave. We're becoming like the Pandora box of agave. All these things that people thought, like, they were like, okay, agave will just make spirits. Oh, no, we are dangerous and armed and funded. So,
most importantly, funded.
You know, we one of the things that we did while we were in New York was we were hanging out with Sother Teague over at Amore Amargo, and we agreed to do some crossover episodes of our podcast. So, I don't want to get too much into the detail, particularly because it might change, but in essence, we're going to throw some challenges at them with some Mexican spirits in terms of how to take these odd spirits they've never tasted and turn them into cocktails.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that. That would be cool.
If that's not exciting, what the hell it is, Lou?
Wait, no one heard this at all. It's all good. All right, guys, I'm gonna do my thing right now. Thank you both for coming on the show. Hey everyone, if you're listening to this program, please follow them on Instagram at Sacred Agave and at Agave Road Trip. You can also follow us at Cutting the Curd and myself at Kara Warren, and please listen and subscribe to Cutting the Curd via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks, and eat more cheese.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.